This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On March 1st, former U.S. Secretary of Education under President George W. Bush, Margaret Spellings, began her first day as president of the University of North Carolina system. During her time in Washington, she was one of the principal proponents of the No Child Left Behind Act, and during her time as Secretary of Education, she convened the Commission on the Future of Higher Education. She would go on to form her own education consulting firm before taking her position as the head of the UNC system. Her arrival there has not been without controversy, beginning with the manner in which her predecessor was asked to resign, to protests on the various UNC campuses that greeted her first day on the job. But Margaret Spellings is making the rounds of the various campuses, and as part of her introduction to Charlotte, she joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be here.
And welcome to Charlotte. By the way, if you have questions, what do you want to ask Margaret Spellings, you can join us by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or searching for WFAE on Facebook or Charlotte Talks on Twitter. Did the protests surrounding your arrival here, either before you got here or once you took office on that very first day, did they surprise you?
Well, a little bit, in as much as I hadn't done anything. I hadn't even shown up yet. But, you know, welcome to the NFL, right? I mean, that's the price of public service these days, sadly. And it is one thing that I worry about, not just for myself, but, you know, if people who are interested in serving in public life, in government, it's a hard job. And, you know, people, we need support. We don't need unanimity. But to be protested before I'd done anything was a bit surprising.
Do you understand their point of view?
Oh, sure. And I don't expect everyone to agree with me. I expect to listen actively. That's why I'm spending the first 100 days in my tenure traveling around to see every campus, to ask people what they're proud of, what they worry about, meet with students and faculty and administrators and community leaders. And absolutely, don't expect to agree with everyone. But, you know, I've got a job to do, and we've got to move the needle on the things that are important to all of us.
The Washington Post called your appointment a disturbing new low. That's a pretty big slap in the face, given a statement like that and some of the other things that have been said by students and faculty. How do you react to that? I mean, how does that affect a human being personally, not just Margaret Spellings, president of the university, but Margaret Spellings?
Well, I think, you know, it's a good thing to have a bar set low for you, because then when you achieve anything, people think, wow, maybe she's not that bad. And, I've had a good track record of success in the public arena during my career. For those who thought it was a disturbing new low, they sought an academic, someone with a PhD, a researcher, a scholar, and I am not that. But I have spent 30 years of my life working across the aisle to try to move the needle on public policy, particularly in education and around closing the achievement gap, and that's what I'm here to do.
And there were those who expressed concerns because prior to your appointment, you had allegedly worked, I don't know if this is true or not, for for-profit colleges and for a student loan collection agency. Is that true?
I was on the board of a for-profit college, yes, and I was an advisor to an organization that is the number one collection agency for the United States Department of Education.
Okay.
So a contractor of the Obama administration I was an advisor to, along with a former governor, a provost of a higher ed institution, and so forth. And they sought people like me to advise them on how best to interface with students as they looked at financial issues around pursuing higher education.
So there were concerns about that because for-profit is a concern for a lot of people, and certainly student loans being what they are today and the massive debt that students have, that's a concern for a lot of particularly young people and their parents. But let me turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn that can help you in your job now from being associated with those organizations?
Well, the for-profit colleges, and I was on the board of the premier institution, the University of Phoenix, and frankly, they invented online higher education. In a way that was convenient for adult learners and in an a la carte sort of way. And I think I've learned a lot about how people attain higher education through technology, and many of those same principles that were brought to the marketplace by private providers are now being embraced in the public sector. And so, I mean, I've learned a lot in everything I've done, including that, and I'm proud of my background and what that means to to my success here and to the issues here.
I'm assuming, because of your association with George W. Bush, going back to when he was governor of Texas, that you are a Republican.
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay. And there are people who are concerned about Republicans, particularly with regard to higher education, and particularly with regard to higher education in North Carolina, because the legislature became Republican, the governor is Republican, and John Fenebresque, who removed your predecessor from his position with a lot of help from the board and brought you in, is also a Republican, and it's a Republican board of governors. And Republicans have a different point of view, at least that's what we are told, about education. Should we be afraid of Republicans running higher education?
Absolutely not. I mean, the thing that has distinguished this state, and it is the crown jewel of what has made North Carolina a unique and wonderful place to live, is the University of North Carolina system. Democrats and Republicans know that. And they understand that it's what's driving our economy and providing opportunity for all citizens. You know, this is public policy is always made in a political setting. That's our American system of democracy. And so I'm very confident that Republican and Democrat alike will see the merit of investing in this institution and providing opportunity and economic growth in the state.
Well, you said recently that you characterized education as a new civil right, and stressed that historically we've done a good job of educating elites, but that isn't the only game in town. That should give, I don't know, rise to some positive attitudes among people who maybe are on the fence about you, don't you think?
I hope so. I also happen to believe it and have a track record of that sort of approach to public policy for the last many decades at the state level and at the federal level. And I do believe we're in a global knowledge economy, and our success is going to be determined at how well we provide education for all citizens.
So if education is the new civil right, do you agree with Bernie Sanders that public education at the college level should be free?
I do not. but let me say this. It is virtually free for our neediest students. So whether you're attending a community college or one of the institutions in the University of North Carolina system, if you have a Pell Grant and financial aid, you pretty much attend college for free anyway, and those opportunities are available. So, can we do more? Absolutely. Our challenge is, honestly, around not just affordability, but around access in terms of, are our students ready to be successful in higher education when they show up on day one? Are they ready to do college-level work? And so that means that we need to make sure that the teachers that we're preparing in the UNC system and who teach in our K-12 schools are ready, willing, and able to do that job of making sure our students are prepared. So it's not just about affordability. It's about preparedness. It's about access. It's about convenience. It's about completion and throughput and scheduling and all of the things that are before us.
What do you think people who are afraid of you should know about you?
Well, I think they should know that I have spent many decades in public policy on the battlefield, putting myself in these positions to try to provide educational opportunity for everyone. And I think they should look at my track record. Those who say that I'm going to privatize American higher education ought to show me some evidence that I've ever tried to do that. And so I think all I'd ask is for people to give me a chance. I expect to have a much more in common with my detractors than I do different.
But let's go back to the beginning. You're not from Texas. You were born in Michigan, right?
Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Where
yes.
were you raised?
Mostly in Texas. My dad was Canadian and was getting a PhD at the University of Michigan. Met my mother and got in the oil and gas business, and that's how we ended up in Houston, Texas. I was about 7 years old, 6 or 7 years old when I moved there. I'm the oldest of four girls from 5 years from top to bottom. My sisters say I had a staff of four by the age of five. So anyway, I grew up in Houston, and I consider myself a Texan.
And I understand, this could be wrong, but I understand that your entire educational experience has been at public schools.
Absolutely.
No private schools.
None. Yes, and so Houston ISD and Texas A&M University and the University of Houston. And here we are in Charlotte. I told Chancellor Dubois that I feel right at home here because the University of North Carolina at Charlotte looks a whole lot like the University of Houston, a big urban university,
right,
providing opportunity in an affordable way to first-generation students, incredible connectedness with the business community, great base of support with non-alums because they understand what this institution means to the vibrancy of the city. So I feel right at home here in Charlotte.
And you have a BA in political science from the University of Houston. How did you make the pathway from that into education, which you spent a lot of your career focusing on?
Right. Well, it's all been in a political setting in the sense that I worked around the state legislature in Texas for many years. I represented school boards. I led external affairs for the Texas Association of School Boards. Went to Washington, worked at the White House, and then ended up at the U.S. Department of Education leading it. So it's all been, you know, public policy. That's what political scientists do if you're a practitioner. And so though my parents were quite skeptical about choosing that liberal arts major, I think I've made a go of it.
Margaret Spellings is our guest, former U.S. Secretary of Education and now the president of the University of North Carolina system here on WFAE. They were skeptical of liberal arts education. Why?
Well, I think, there's actually, to me, a false argument going on right now about whether we should be about lifelong learning and civic engagement and a study of and pursuit of the liberal arts, or whether we should be about training people for the workplace. And both are true. And we are well equipped to be able to do both of those things in this system.
You're also a mother, and you have, what, two daughters?
I have two daughters and a son-in-law.
And you have been able to see education from the point of view of somebody who's been heavily involved in terms of public policy with regard to education and through the eyes of a mother shepherding her daughters through schools.
Right.
Did they go to public schools? Did they go to private schools?
They did. Both, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Was when I was the Secretary of Education, I was, interestingly, the first mother of school children to serve in that capacity. And I used to say, you know, what took them so long to get somebody that knew what was going on in the schools? But yes, I've been a user of the system. And so when people talk to me about the FAFSA, the free application for student aid, and the complexity of that, I know of what they speak. When people ask me about how they know a good teacher when they see one, how they can understand the data on their schools and whether their schools are good and opportunities can be had for their children, I understand that as a user of the system myself.
So did you see anything as a mother of children in elementary or secondary education that disturbed you?
Well, I think there's an idea that some people care about their children and the opportunities before them, and some don't. And I completely reject that. I've traveled to a lot of schools, primary, secondary, and post-secondary schools, and I never met families or citizens or leaders that did not want to provide opportunity for their students and did not want their kids to achieve at the highest levels possible. And so this idea that, you know, the haves and the have-nots, and that's what I mean when I say education is the new civil right. That's our clarion call today, to provide those opportunities for every single person.
Why do you think that that's not believed by a lot of people when they look at Republicans?
Well, frankly, I used to hear it, you know, often from the other side of the aisle. You know, No Child Left Behind, you know, became Nickleby, as in Nicholas. That it was about, you know, poor students. It was about have-nots. It was about those children, et cetera. And so I think those are false distinctions, and that's what I'm here to elevate, opportunity for everyone.
Margaret Spellings is our guest, the new president of the University of North Carolina system. We have a lot to talk about as we go through the hour. We'll take some of your calls and questions as well. Not calls, but questions as well when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Margaret Spellings, who is the new president of the University of North Carolina system. Went through her whole life in public schools and is a mother of two children who also shed some light for her personally on the state of American education. Worked in Texas under Governor Clements, I believe, as an associate executive. I beg your pardon?
And Governor Bush.
Yes.
Yeah.
As an associate executive director of the Texas Association of School Boards and for an education reform commission in Texas as well. In Texas, what was that education reform commission trying to reform?
Well, like many states in that era, we struggled with the constitutionality of our school finance system. And so, over the better part of a decade, we had serious litigation around the constitutionality of our system. And so every governor would appoint a task force that would look at the funding system, but also what we needed to do to drive achievement. So,
because there are some things that have been going on in Texas, and Texas is so large that it really does control how the textbooks are actually written for most of the country.
Texas and California.
And there's some things that have been going on in Texas with regard to politics and policy and who we should look at in our history that have been disturbing to a lot of people. Should we be concerned about Texas as the place where all of this stuff emanates?
Well, it's Texas and California, and obviously the big purchasers drive the kinds of materials that are available. And that's why the Common Core has become an interesting issue, because it seeks to be more precise about what are in the kinds of things that are in those materials and that are broadly available. You know, again, we're back to public policy making in a political setting, and this is a representative democracy. We have elected state boards of education and local boards of education in Texas, and people feel strongly about what their children ought to be exposed to. Yeah. And those get, you know, there was a lot of controversy about errors in the books, so those obviously need to be corrected, and also just the way that history often is portrayed.
While you were Secretary of Education, you convened the Commission on the Future of Higher Education, and you talked about this a little bit a few minutes ago, which it released a report about 10 years ago that included a call for colleges and universities to focus on training students for the workforce. And our Governor McCrory, has also made similar statements, and a lot of focus, particularly at the community college level, has been put toward training students to where essentially Central Piedmont Community College has essentially become, in some areas, a training company for other companies. Not that getting a job after college isn't important, but is that the end-all, be-all? Is that what a college education is for, strictly to walk out the door and get a high-paying job?
Well, it's a big part of it. Of course, it's not the sole task of higher education. We all need to be able to read and write and think and cipher and be lifelong learners and have the skills to be able to access the workplace, not only immediately after completion of higher education, but over the term of one's life. And as I said, those are not mutually exclusive. I mean, darn few of us have the luxury of not needing to have a J-O-B after college and throughout our lives.
In a speech to the Board of Governors at UNC in February, you said that we must excel in affordability as the state constitution calls us to do, and we must provide the best chances for success in employment and in life. These goals must be clear and measurable. Can you accomplish that for someone who's getting a philosophy or an English or a history degree and not something in the sciences where they're going to go out and work in a laboratory for some big company?
I think so. I think absolutely. Here's what we know for sure is that students who graduate from college in any discipline are much better off in life, period. And so because it conveys a sense of being able to complete something, and it demonstrates a level of literacy and competency and higher order thinking that is relevant in any endeavor and any employer. So you bet. I think we can do that. I think we must do that.
We talked a little bit about your upbringing and how your schooling, et cetera. Why are you interested in education?
Well, as all of us understand that it is what is the ticket to the American dream, and that's certainly been true for me and for everybody I know. I mean, if you're going to be successful in America, you need to have access to affordable education, and you need to be able to apply those skills in whatever endeavor you pursue. And I have seen it change so many lives and hear stories every single day about first-generation college students who changed the trajectory of their family because of education.
We have some people who have been writing in as we've been talking, and I hope I say this name correctly. Nefetera on Twitter asks, why don't you believe that higher education should be free?
Well, as I say, for the neediest students among us, it is free. And I think, you know, the numbers just have to work, period. And we, you know, there is something to be said for, you know, when you spend your hard-earned money and you make an investment in yourself, that you're more likely to appreciate it, to commit yourself to it, and to complete. And so just like, you know, I mean, I guess we could talk about free housing or free transportation or free anything. I think there's something to be said for investing in yourself on your own behalf.
But what if you can't afford it?
Well, if you can't afford it, there's lots of financial aid available. We have Pell Grants. We have all sorts of financial aid.
How difficult are they to get?
Well, it's probably more complicated than it needs to be, and that's something that I've talked a lot about and worked on at the federal level, and that's another story. We can be more helpful to our students in accessing resources, but they're available, especially for those who are qualified and committed to complete.
There are still people who are upset by Dr. Ross's sudden disappearance from the university system, and Gene emails about that, but he asks, what difference do you bring to the UNC system?
Well, what I bring is many decades of success in public policy making across the aisle. And I think it's interesting whether it's Mitch Daniels at Purdue or Janet Napolitano, who came from the Obama administration to lead the University of California system, whether it's Bill McCraven at the University of Texas. More and more higher education boards are turning to people like me because they believe that we can elevate the level of conversation around higher education and the importance of it and get things done in a political setting, whether it's a state legislature or a board of governors or in higher education itself.
And we talked a little bit about this before the show began. You are a political person. You are a lifelong political person. That's why you were attracted, I guess, to working for the governors of Texas and then for the president. And when you were Secretary of Education, I didn't know this till yesterday, but you were also a White House policy advisor addressing issues like transportation, health, justice, housing, and labor. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a sidebar, but there are a lot of White House policy advisors over time, and it always surprises me how you get those jobs. How do you have such an encompassing knowledge of things like transportation, health, justice, housing, and labor?
Yeah,
to advise the president.
I led the domestic policy shop at the White House for the first 4 years of the administration. And what that job is being an honest broker, just like this job, being the interlocutor between agency heads, between experts in the subject and the president, and providing those policy processes to elevate issues that are thorny and difficult, provide the right kind of research and content and expertise so that the president can make a decision. And I'm proud of the work that we did on immigration. I think if and when the Congress finally acts, they'll pass something that is essentially the Bush plan. We can talk a bit more about that if you like, as well as the efforts to lead PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, that I was a major part of and that has really stemmed the scourge of AIDS in Africa and other places.
This is not meant to be a question to challenge you. This is meant to be a question to try to understand how that happens. How did you learn how to do that?
Well, when I first got to Washington, I used to say I'm certainly not a policy expert on all these things, especially at the federal level, but I knew a lot about George Bush. Mm-hmm. I had worked for him for many years. I knew how he thought about things. I knew the kinds of questions he was going to ask. And as I say, my role was not to be an expert, but I obviously became one over time in many of these subjects, but to be the honest broker who knew what to ask, who knew the right questions, where to probe, and the kind of research and expertise that mm-hmm. we needed to garner to make decisions.
You, after leaving the White House, had your own company, your own educational
After leaving the Department of Education.
Okay. Yeah. You had your own educational consulting company. Mm-hmm. You also ran the George W. Bush Presidential Center in mm-hmm. Dallas. I'm sure this job wasn't even on your radar.
Absolutely.
Why?
It was not on my radar.
Why did you want it?
Well, I was approached by the executive search firm that was doing this, and you know I've been mouthing off for many decades about higher education. You mentioned the Commission on the Future of Higher Education, which actually, as a matter of fact, I launched here in Charlotte. It'll be 10 years this coming summer with Governor Hunt, who was one of the members of the of this very august bipartisan commission that looked for the first time, frankly, in a long time, at these issues in higher education. And you know, I'm fully committed to the things that are important. And you know, it's time for me to put myself back on the battlefield and try to get some of them done.
So you've been on this job for 15 days now, and we're taking
that long.
That's right, and we're taking one of those days away from you by just having this conversation. So what are your impressions of the UNC system after 15 days?
Well, just the incredible pride in the system. Everywhere I go, people say this is the most important institution in our state. It is what's differentiated us from other places. It is a diverse set of institutions that fill the needs and meet the needs of a very diverse populace. Just the pride and the respect for this institution are absolutely palpable.
There are 17 campuses, and I know in 15 days you could not have been to all 17.
No, but I'm going to get there in the next few weeks.
So what has emerged from the campuses that you visited and spent time at with the various chancellors you've met and talked with the students and faculty that you've had a chance to meet with? What has anything emerged, aside from what you just said, that you didn't anticipate?
Well, I'm asking, everywhere I go, I ask, you know, what are you proud of? What makes your institution unique? What's the greatest thing about UNC Charlotte, in this case, where I'm visiting today? Mm-hmm. And also, what are you worried about? What are your challenges? And I hear a lot in common around affordability and access. I hear a lot about pay for staff and faculty to make sure that we engender the right kind of support to have these institutions thrive over the long haul. I hear a lot about culture and the environment on a college campus so that students can be successful there. There's really more in common than there is different.
Interesting that you bring up money, because the Washington Post, again, reports that the UNC system has seen its state of per student funding slashed by some 25%. Since 2008, and there have been suggestions that certain of the university's efforts be curtailed. One example is the UNC Board of Governors issuing a draft report which recommends closing Chapel Hill's Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity, which is run by a professor who's critical of Republican policies in the state. That aside, is the university getting enough money?
Well, you mentioned the fact that, and frankly, North Carolina is not unique. During the Great Recession, many states cut back on support for higher education just as a way to balance budgets, and that's when we saw fairly dramatic increases in tuition. So North Carolina is not unique. It still is one of the most affordable higher ed systems in the country and always ranks at the bottom. I think people maybe don't understand what a great value higher education is here in North Carolina.
And this may not be a fair question to ask you after 15 days on the job, but maybe this was something that was discussed with you by the Board of Governors when they hired you. Is the university spending the money that it has wisely?
It's not a fair question to ask me 15 days on the job, but I don't know, but I'll find out. And that's one of the things that I think is my job, to make sure that whatever resources we have are stewarded in the best way possible. And, you know, I'm going to rely on the way I think about these things is to be very clear about our expectations of our chancellors, what we expect from them in terms of completion and affordability and retention of faculty and staff and on, and then we get out of their way to let them run their business, and that we're very hawkish about outcomes, but how they do it is we need to rely on them as sophisticated managers to run these enterprises.
Can you cut costs and curtail programs and maintain the integrity and the quality and the reputation of the University of North Carolina over time?
I think so. I mean, to suggest that everything works perfectly at the University of North Carolina or any enterprise is ill-conceived.
Because at one time, you hear this all over the state, at one time this school was considered one of the finest public universities in the country.
It still is.
I was going to ask you, is it
absolutely
still today?
Absolutely. You bet it is. That's why I'm here. I think we can take a great system and make it the greatest. I think we can lead the nation in affordability and in accountability and completion for our students. I think we are positioned to do that, and with a lot of support, financial and otherwise, I think we will do that.
Margaret Spellings is our guest. She's the new head of the University of North Carolina system. There's a lot more to talk about as we go through the hour here with her, and that includes her work on No Child Left Behind. And I want to get your impressions on what has replaced No Child Left Behind, and talk to me about Common Core, which is a mystery to us all. But we'll do that as we go through the program here on Right. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. John emails, what is your opinion of the decision last year to close three important UNC centers, in particular the Poverty Center, which I already mentioned at UNC, and the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Center at NC Central? These decisions were highly politicized, part of an offensive by the state legislature against civil rights and the welfare of the poor citizens. Those are John's words, not mine. Mm-hmm. And he says, I know these decisions predated your appointment by a few weeks, but I hope you have an opinion. These closings were, after all, part of the same process that brought you to our system from the Bush Library.
You know, I really am not very well briefed on those decisions and those issues. I certainly can find out more and probably should. Whether they were politically motivated or not, I cannot say. I mean, again, I think this board, and I hope I will help them do this, is charged with stewarding resources the most productive way possible. And I'm not sure what the motivations were behind the closure of those centers, but certainly we'll find out.
What is your take? Because a lot of schools are now beginning to focus on putting classes online. Mm-hmm. And a lot of students across the world are taking classes from
27,000 of them, yes, in this system.
What is your take on that? Is that something that is the future of higher education? Is that something that can be properly policed? Because if you are learning everything online and taking tests online, every test is an open book test.
It's certainly part of the future of higher education. You bet it is. If we're going to be convenient and relevant and enhancing people's skills all along life's way, technology is a big part of higher education, just as it is in every other area of life. And there are certainly things that can be done to safeguard the integrity of assessment and those sorts of things, and they're being done now. You bet. There's many, many blended learning models that are going on within this system as part of the offerings, including at this institution, and also an online presence where more than 27,000 students are accessing higher education.
Because Duncan emails, and we only have 45 seconds, the University of Phoenix has a 5% graduation rate and a 26.4% student loan default rate. Is that acceptable to you? And did you address this on your board as you discussed things like online learning?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think our completion rates at every single institution, for-profit, non-profit, private, and public, can be enhanced. I would say that the type of student that is accessing higher education at for-profit institutions is also often not as skilled as those that come every day in physical plants. So it's about where the student starts.
Margaret Spellings, our guest on Charlotte Talks today. She's the president of the University of North Carolina system, her 15th day on the job. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Margaret Spellings is our guest. She's the new president of the University of North Carolina system, former U.S. Secretary of Education under President George W. Bush. That would be Bush 43 by my count. CAD on Facebook asks a touchy question. How will you bridge the gap between academe at the schools and the anti-intellectual state Republicans?
Well, I think the tenor and tone of that question is part of our problem, and that is that we ascribe ill will and bad motive to people whose point of view is different from ours. And I certainly hope not to do that and maybe be part of breaking down those barriers. Republicans and Democrats in this state and this country believe in higher education, have invested heavily in it over our history, and understand that that's the way that we're going to grow our economies and provide opportunity for our citizens, period, paragraph. We all share that.
And Mike, who is not voting for Bernie Sanders today, emails, how much are taxpayers on average paying for each student in public colleges and universities in North Carolina? Taxpayers are already paying a great deal for higher education here, even though most taxpayers do not go to college and do not have children in college. Is this fair?
Well, the fundamental part of that question is it varies. The cost of higher education varies throughout the system. And so, I mean, obviously there are numbers. I don't know them off the top of my head, but certainly they're discoverable. You know, I think all what we understand as Americans is that investing in public education, public higher education, and public primary and secondary education is a good value for all taxpayers because it makes for an educated workforce. It makes for growing economies. And whether you're a user of the system yourself, it makes for a better place and a better life.
Your predecessor was chosen at a time of a Democratic legislature, probably by a more Democratic Board of Governors, and there are people who feel that he was forced out because of the shift toward Republican control of the legislature and the governor's office and the Board of Governors. So maybe he was asked to leave because he wasn't doing some of the things that the Board of Governors would like for him to have done. What have they told you they would like for you to do?
Well, for starters, I think they expect me and my team at the General Administration and the people who are in institutions like Chancellor Dubois here in Charlotte to provide leadership around higher education.
That wasn't being done before?
Well, I'm not saying it was or wasn't. I'm saying that this is what they expect me to do going forward.
Okay.
We didn't spend a lot of time, honestly, talking about the past. The past is honestly less relevant to me than what's ahead. And so how are we going to make sure that we're going to enhance affordability and completion? How will we make sure that we garner the levels of support and resources from the legislature so that we can invest in these institutions, so that we can drive the economy and opportunity here?
Did they explain their vision for what they want this university to be?
Well, I think they understand that we need to be able to convey our value proposition very clearly to our fellow citizens. And, I think in higher education in the past, we've had kind of a send us the money and leave us alone attitude. And I don't know that that's any longer sustainable. We need to make sure that we are conveying the value proposition that we provide to taxpayers, like the questioner who just wrote in, as to what's in it for them.
So accountability.
You bet.
Is what they want. But in your recent speech to the Board of Governors, you said that you can be expected to listen to everyone, including them, the Board of Governors, and to be respectful of the board's time as fiduciaries providing oversight, not management. Was that to stave off any potential meddling in your operation of the university, or could you say that because they hired you and you're of like minds and therefore there won't be any meddling?
I think we all need to be in the proper swim lanes, if I would just say it like that. I do not. They are a policy-making board. They are a policy-setting board. They're fiduciaries of this university. I am the executive, the day-to-day manager of this enterprise, and I'm going to rely on the 17 leaders of these institutions to do the, work where the rubber meets the road, and that's with students, the most important part of the enterprise. And I think we all need to understand clearly what our role and responsibility is. I think in the past, those lines have been blurred for whatever reason that are, immaterial to me about why those lines were blurred. But I think we all need to understand there's plenty of work for all of us, and we need to be in our right swim lane.
As Secretary of Education, you led the implementation of No Child Left Behind. And the purpose of that program, as I understand it, was to provide greater accountability at the elementary school level. That program has since been scrapped. In your opinion, did it work?
It absolutely did work, and it has not been scrapped. The major
essence... Hasn't it been replaced by...
been reauthorized by... And there's a new law called ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act.
Okay.
And late last year, I was a strong supporter of that reauthorization because it included the key provision of No Child Left Behind, which is to assess every single student every year, to disaggregate that data, in other words, to report it by type of student, and to hold our schools accountable for achievement. Now, the primary shift in the law is instead of a federal role around accountability and enforcement, if you will, that has now been ceded to states and local school districts. And so we'll see how well they embrace that mandate to close the achievement gap. But the guts of No Child Left Behind is about transparency and accountability, it's still there.
But it also brought a lot of testing to the fore.
It did. And
that angered a lot of parents and a lot of students and a lot of teachers.
You know, when people talk to me about that, I said, well, what's the alternative? Should we go back to the days of not caring enough to find out about how well our students
are
doing?
Well, you and I both went through schools, in public schools, at a time when Washington wasn't quite as in control as it has become with No Child Left Behind.
And when the achievement for poor and minority students was in the gutter. And that has changed. We have focused more on poor and minority students because of No Child Left Behind than ever in the history of our country. And we have seen the needle move, and that is why the civil rights organizations like LULAC and Education Trust and some of the other organizations in Washington have been strong supporters of it.
But there are Republicans right now running for president who want to abolish the Department of Education.
And I worked for one that didn't.
Do you understand those who do want to abolish it?
You know, I really don't. I don't understand that. I think I believe that education, if we're in a global knowledge economy, it is how we will provide citizens opportunity.
What is Washington's role in it then?
It's always been, since the creation of the federal role in the LBJ administration around a civil rights agenda, to make sure that we provided a level playing field for all students. And so whether it was special education.
States can't be trusted to do that?
Well, we tried it for many, many decades. It was a strategy that I call the put the money out and hope for the best. And we tried it. And what we saw was giant achievement gaps for poor, minority, and special needs students. And when we at the federal level started saying, we're going to invest taxpayer dollars as good Republicans and good financial stewards, but we expect and we want something for those investments, then we began to see the needle move.
So we have No Child Left Behind, this new act that you just referenced that I keep...
ESSA.
Thank you. I keep forgetting the name of it. That we have Race to the Top as well. All of these efforts to help children in primary and secondary education do better and to hold schools and teachers and administrators accountable for their doing better and succeeding. Is that all working? Are kids coming to the University of North Carolina prepared to do the work of a college student? Can they think? Can they read? Can they do math? Have they been asked as elementary school and secondary school students to critically think? Or just simply to repeat back and put a little dot on a test paper, A, B, C, or D?
Well, obviously we have work to do. Not every student is college ready, and that's why we will continue to talk about these
issues.
But
why not? We give free student educations to people K through 12. Why aren't they ready?
Well, in no small part because they're not there to learn. I mean, our dropout rates with poor and minority students are still way too high. On average, nationally, about half of our minority students complete high school on time in a day and time when we're ever-growing diverse populations. And so, you know, if half the kids are getting out of high school on time, we're not going to have successful colleges and universities.
There are presidential candidates in the Republican Party today still referencing and running against Common Core. Mm-hmm. Common Core, as I understand it, was a Republican idea put forth by the states. And there are states who are controlled by Republicans, this one among them, that rejected Common Core. Do you understand that? Are you on board with Common Core?
Well, I've supported it because the standards are higher and clearer and better. But whether states embrace as their own at their own selection or election, you know, Common Core standards or something that looks and smells and is sound like those standards but called something else. I mean, the point of fact is states have standards for curriculum and for learning, and whether they're called Common Core and whether they're part of that consortium or something else, as they are in Texas and Virginia and other states, is a matter of local control. What matters is not what the name of the thing is, but you know, how well are students achieving those higher bar standards.
You've been attacked from all sides on a lot of different issues. And the Huffington Post headlined a story in November of last year this way: Margaret Spellings is too homophobic for UNC. And the story called for you to openly welcome gay students, staff, and faculty. Do you welcome them?
Absolutely. And every other type of student. Every ethnicity, every race, you name it, I am here to represent and to serve every single student of every type in this system, period.
Have your views on this subject, as the presidents have, evolved, to use his word, or is this something you've always felt?
Listen, this netted from my repeating of a phrase in an interview the day I was selected. So the questioner used a phrase, and I stupidly repeated it. My record on opportunity for all students is strong, and I stand by it. When the faculty senate at UNC Chapel Hill passed a resolution urging me to represent the needs of all students, I sent them a letter and said, "You bet, count on it."
Well, when you were Secretary of Education, one of the first things that you did was that you asked PBS to refund federal funding because there were four gay characters on an animated television show that I'd never heard of before called Buster the Bunny.
Yeah, Buster the Bunny was a program aimed at early literacy for 3 to 5 year old students. And I think people underappreciate what this issue looked like more than 10 years ago, at a time when, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act was supported by nearly all Democrats and Republicans. And so, yes, it was a matter of using federal funds. I asked the stations to notify, I asked PBS to notify their stations about the content of the programming and to consider refunding the funds to the Department of Education.
Would you do that?
The leaders of public broadcasting elected on their own not to air the program.
Would you do that today?
No. I think attitudes about those every kind of diversity have been jumped over. It's now a complete and supportable part of American life, and I think people don't understand how different that is today than it was more than a decade ago.
Margaret Spellings is our guest on WFAE, the new president of the University of North Carolina system here on Charlotte Talks, because you're about to run the biggest public television and radio system in the state of North Carolina, UNC-TV and UNC Public Radio up in Chapel Hill and Durham and places like that. What will be your position on that? What will be your point of attack on that? Will you just let them run themselves?
Well, I think our challenge is how we use these amazing assets of television and radio to enhance our core mission of education. We're educating people right now, but how do we harness those assets around completion and opportunity? And I think we can look closely at that. I mean, obviously, the way the business model is derived, are these financially sustainable organizations that can be vibrant over the long haul? That's certainly an issue. As we think,
well, because another perception, and it may be incorrect among a lot of people, is that Republicans are not big fans of public broadcasting.
Well, I'm a big fan of public broadcasting.
Why?
Because I think it is part of our of educating Americans about of keeping people informed. I mean, in fact, we had a conversation up in a meeting a few hours ago, which is that particularly since reporting has changed so much in the private sector, that it's often public systems like this that are the people who can do the homework on real journalism around higher education or K-12 education or any public policy issue that's before us. And we have a responsibility to elevate good thinking and civic engagement around that.
So you have one of the biggest jobs in the state of North Carolina, and probably one of the most important jobs. And it's an enormous job. Where do you begin? What are your priorities?
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is get about the state and meet people and listen. What are they proud of? Where do we have work to do? And so on. Secondly, I'm going to make sure that the general administration, the staff, and the capabilities and skills and people that we have around this system are the right actors, the right players, doing the right things in this challenging time. And thirdly, I need to go to the legislature at the end of April when they come back for the short session and seek some funding for priorities that we share.
Only have time for a short answer to this, but I got to tell you, that you are a very brave woman because you appeared on Jon Stewart's Daily Show.
Yes.
You appeared on the Colbert Report.
Yes.
And you appeared while Secretary of Education.
I know.
On Jeopardy.
Yes.
And came in second. I watched that show, by the way.
It was, yeah, what was
why,
I thinking?
Why were you,
what
why
was
did you
I
do,
thinking?
Why did you do those shows in 10 seconds or less?
Well, I stopped short of doing Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader because I knew that was a loser either way. You know, to have fun and to get to know people and to just show that you know, I'm a whole person, a real person.
Margaret Spellings, former Secretary of Education under the Bush administration and president now of the University of North Carolina System. Thank you for the hour.